we're finding that the off-market approach is really the best way to go.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts, passing on their experience and knowledge to our listeners. Thanks for joining us this week. My name's J. Darren Gross. We're so glad you're here. In just a minute, we're going to speak with Rick Bean, a commercial real estate broker in the Rose City, Portland, Oregon, about the market conditions. We get into cap rates, value of a good broker, and how to be successful in negotiating in a hot market. But before we do, we would like to invite you to subscribe to our program if you like what we're doing. You can do that by going to either iTunes or Stitcher, whichever you prefer. We're on both. It's really easy. All you do is you go to either the iTunes or the Stitcher, and in the search bar, type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. And then when you see the headphones, that's our logo, it's the headphones with CREPN between the ears. Go ahead and click subscribe, and that'll ensure that you hear all of our episodes, or you know when any new episode is posted, and then you can listen anytime you choose, whether it's in the car, at the gym, or even at your kid's sports practice. When you do subscribe, we'd love to have you leave a comment and let us know what you think. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a real estate investor and a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for over 25 years, and my primary clients are real estate professionals dealing in multifamily, retail, warehouse, office, and development. Also, I'm a real estate investor and have been for almost 20 years, and it's based on this that I created Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio so that I could better support my clients and also learn some information that I can use in my own investing. Insurance is always a part of any real estate transaction, and when you or your clients are making an offer, and if you need any insurance, or if you have any questions, let's just put it that way. If you have any questions, give me a call. I do all I can to help. That's what I do. The easiest way to reach me, you can do that at jdarrengross.com, or you can also reach me at commercialrealestateprpronetwork.com. My contact information is listed on both. And one more thing, if you're on LinkedIn, can't encourage you enough to check out our group. We've got a group called Commercial Real Estate Pro Network, a great group of commercial real estate professionals, good place to network and learn more. All right, so the show today, it's again, we're talk with Rick Bean. And if you're a serious buyer or a seller and you want to deal with a professional that knows what's going on and is looking out for your best interest and someone who knows the marketplace. And earlier I had the opportunity to speak with Rick Bean of Rose City Commercial Real Estate. On the line with me today, I'm lucky to have Rick Bean. Rick Bean's with Rose City Commercial Real Estate. Rick, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Darren. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you making time for us today. Good way to start the day. Rick, before we get going, if you could do me a favor and the listeners a favor and give us just a little bit of an introduction, tell a little bit about your practice, how long you've been a commercial broker, and we'll take it from there.
I'd be glad to. I come from a commercial real estate family back generations, but I didn't get into it myself until I was in my 50s, and I have loved it. It's actually my true calling. I started out working for a large real estate investment trust that had 7,500 apartments. And the first job we did was a $106 million acquisition of three towers that were being converted into condos, three apartment towers. Then when the recession hit, transactional real estate just died. And so what I did was I went together with a friend and we formed a company that did property tax appeals. That way, wherever I am, the sun is shining over my head, no matter what the economic circumstances.
That's pretty wise, because if there's anything that's played out in my lifetime, it's the high and the low, the hot and the cold. There's no buyers, there's not no property, the yin and the yang of the real estate market. So good to have something that you know, you can rely on, especially and that, you know, it's interesting to bring that up, the tax record appeal. You know, it's amazing to me how the market is, or the tax records are supposed to be based on what the properties are selling for, or what they're based on, or what their value is. But they don't always rewind when the market rewinds, unless you say, "Hey, mine's not worth that."
Yeah. So, and we ran into that. And Oregon is one of the strangest states for property tax appeals, because we have this Measure 5 and Measure 50 that impact that significantly. You know, you can only go up 3% other than special levies and so forth. But it goes up 3% every year. And so when property values plummet, your tax liability actually increases, which is, you know,
nobody
doesn't
likes
make
them.
Sense to a lot of folks. And we had a lot of multifamily properties where they had much lower occupancy than they had previously had. They were getting less rents, and the capitalization rate that they were valued at dropped. So now we had people whose properties were not making money. As a matter of fact, in some cases, they were having to come out of their own pocket with operating funds. And in some even worse cases, they were asked by their banks to meet minimum debt service coverage ratios, which meant that, if their loan, the equity in their property dropped below a certain point, they had to give the bank more money to make sure they stayed in balance.
Wow.
It was a disaster, but I'm glad that we're where we are now.
Yeah, I was going to say that's hopefully we don't have to go back to visit that topic for a while yet.
No.
And we're on the flip side of that right now. You know, here in Portland, and I think pretty much across the country. I know I've talked to some people in some of the Midwestern states that haven't experienced, tremendous, demand for product, but I don't know that they ever really dropped off like some of the markets. But here in Portland, and that's what we were hoping to talk to, about today, is just about,
sure,
you know, kind of the marketplace, what it is today, and what you've seen that's changed, since the fall back in 07, and how just the market's heated up, so if you can give us a little perspective on what you're seeing. And before we jump into that, do you primarily play in apartments still, or do you?
I still, when people call me up and say that they would love for me to represent them, do tenant representation on a lease, I still work those products, but my passion is for apartments, and that's where I spend most of my time.
Got it.
And it's what I like, and it's been a good fit for me. Years ago, you couldn't give away apartments because they weren't performing well. Now we're seeing apartments have, for a significant period of time, several years, been the dominant sector in the commercial real estate. They've really been the belle of the ball. And one of the reasons for that is as much as we love Costco, you don't have to have a new Costco, but we as a society have decided that we do need to house people to the extent possible. And so there is a continuing need for additional apartments. Now that need was stymied when the economy was in the toilet, but so much pent-up demand, particularly here in Portland, where they didn't build for years, pent-up demand broke free, and now we're seeing building, we're seeing rising rents, so this is one of the hottest markets in America right now.
Yeah, and excuse me, in some of the just that pent-up demand that you were speaking about, you know, it is kind of an interesting thing when you look back at, you know, prior to the crash, how much of the market was focused on, and there were apartments, but I remember there being, you know, just huge single-family developments. A lot of the apartments were being converted to condos. Condos were kind of the rage. And, were there a lot of apartments that you were dealing with back then, or was that kind of what you were seeing as well?
Yes. I actually, my first job was to be a market researcher for a large company that owned 7,500 apartment units across the in Portland, Phoenix, Albuquerque, Las Vegas. And I would go in and research markets and assist them with their acquisitions. And I think we bought a quarter of $1 billion in that 2-year period there.
Did they keep them as apartments then, or were they doing any conversions? Or
well, the three towers downtown, the Harrison Towers, was an example of a project where they bought the three towers, 555 units, converted them to and upgraded them. The first tower they sold out in days and weeks. The second tower much slower, but they sold that out as condos. And the third tower, they said, you know what? The market's changed. Let's, you know, the first rule of selling is sell them what they want to buy. And the market had said, no, condos were no longer the rage. The property was actually more valuable as apartments at that point. And so it was sold as a single tower of apartments.
Huh. No, I mean, that was kind of an interesting transition there. And I've got a client that they had worked and worked and worked, you know, trying to get this project off the ground, permitted, et cetera, for a condo. And just like you're describing, the market literally, I don't want to say changed overnight, but there was kind of all of a sudden there was a willingness of the banks for the project going one way, and all of a sudden that flipped to saying, no, we don't like that, but if you do it this way, okay, we'll make it an apartment. And, you know, they were very happy that they did do that, but it was kind of an interesting transition from, you know, thinking one moment you're going to be building. I mean, the construction was similar. I mean, very similar. It was a multifamily building. Right. Just the end use there. But
they do tend on a condo conversion. They do tend to use higher end cabinets, higher end finishes, soundproofing, improved soundproofing.
Sure.
So a little bit different. Right now, apartments are so valuable as apartments, they can't be converted economically. Condominiums are not selling for as much money as the highest and best use of, in most cases right now, is actually as an apartment rather than a condominium. And that's why we're not seeing, even though we're seeing rapid increases in prices in single family residences, we're not seeing too many condos being built simply because their greater value is as a ongoing revenue stream as an apartment.
Right. Are you finding most of the activity in the Portland metro area? Are you finding any activity outside?
Well, the entire economy, you know, Portland, Oregon has a number of indicators where it's scoring very well. And by that, I'm referring to the Beacons report, basically the ratio of inward moves versus outward moves. As a ratio, Oregon has been number one in the Beacon survey, the highest ratio of inward versus outward moves. It's something like 66% or 68% in and 32% out. That's actually the highest ratio in the United States.
It's almost like Portland, 2 to 1.
About 2 to 1. We've had a number of months where the price of single family homes increase in Oregon or in Portland led the nation. We've had times where the increase in unit rents in Portland has led the nation.
Is that primary? Are you finding that to be a primarily the Portland area driving that, or
is it
statewide?
It's an effect that we're seeing statewide. We're seeing it in Bend. Bend's booming. Before it was in worse shape than Portland.
That was really a remarkable rise and fall over there.
And Portland is, you know, Oregon has I mentioned a number of indices where it's, you know, near the top, and it's beginning to get national attention as a not only an affordable place, but a place with high livability. And I know that for many of us who've been around here and seen where rents have gone, the word, you know, livability, our rents as a percentage of incomes are still lower than a lot of major cities. So
right. We're
still attractive in that sense. There's another thing that's happening that is a basic change in the way the market works, and that's this. The millennials are preferring to live in apartments rather than the buying of a home and the, you know, the lower level of flexibility that gives them. But we're also seeing some people that said, you know, I kind of got burned in that last recession. I think I'd prefer to be a renter just so I don't go through that whole joyride again. And so as a nation, we have peak of single family ownership percentage, which happened several years ago, is dropping and continues to drop.
Yeah, that's a remarkable, in historical perspective, if you think about it, just how, at least when I grew up, it was always about, you know, everybody having a home, you know, that was kind of.
Right, right. Well, and remember, we've seen a 3 or 4% drop in the home ownership percentage. Now, some of that is actually lifestyle renters. People who could afford a home have said, I choose not to do that. They like places like the Strand down on the Willamette River. They like places that are chock full of amenities, and they're going after those Class A properties. But of course, not everybody has a choice where they live. There are some people that are apartment renters by necessity because of their economic circumstances.
Right. Now, there's been many Saturdays when I've been out behind the mower thinking how I'd like to be one of those.
Yeah.
Get out of the yard.
Well, and there's a number of people like you that have actually said, you know, I just don't want to do that. And for that reason, the amount of building of apartments actually does not appear to be overbuilt. It's surprising I see everywhere I go, I see apartments going in, and yet I think we're still below demand, the net absorption.
Yeah, no, we keep hearing kind of the same report, at least for the near future.
Right.
I don't know. Have you seen our rents cooling off? Are they still getting?
Rents are the rate of acceleration has dropped, but they're still going up. Absolutely, they're still going up. And then and one of the things that's happened, of course, is the stock market is not doing as well, or as it's not as solid as people used to feel that it was. There's the larger gyrations in the values. Real estate, even though there are some people who have lost money, and I grant that, but real estate actually is the investment where most people believe that they're going to get the best long-term return.
Right. Well, and I know, even hedge funds and stuff have gone out and bought up a bunch of single families, which...
That's happening in Portland, absolutely.
Yeah, not exactly something I think we would have been talking about 10 years ago.
Years ago, that was unthinkable.
Right.
The hedge funds would only go after institutional grade 200 unit and up properties. Now, there are folks, like you say, that, and they're very active in Portland.
Right.
Which says something about their assessment of the Portland market.
Right. Now, they follow the money, right? If they're.
We're seeing more and more people that, I had an investor one time. He said, Rick, I want a guaranteed investment. And I said, well, the only guaranteed investment I know of is 10-year T-bills. And what I will guarantee you is you'll lose money. You get right now, I think they currently set a new low at 0.8%. So when you can't even get a penny if you won't even give me a penny for me giving you a dollar for a year, that's not a good investment. That's a guaranteed way to lose money through inflation.
Right.
And so because bonds aren't as attractive as a hedge against inflation, stocks have their own volatility. We're seeing more and more people that are bringing significant pieces of equity into the commercial real estate market and residential as well.
Right. Let me ask you something. So when you have hedge funds coming to town, are you also seeing any foreign?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. There are significant foreign investors. I've worked with some myself. And one of the things that's done is that's driven prices up a little bit. But when people look at the potential yield, they still are attracted because there's still more upside.
Right. So with all of this additional demand from places such as hedge funds and foreign investors, is the property being presented to the marketplace the same? I mean, brokers.
Well, this has definitely switched from a buyer's market to a seller's market. I years ago, I used to work with people that would say, they come to me and say, hey, Rick, I want to make an advantageous buy. Here's $5 million cash. And I want something that's got good long-term potential. And I would approach the owner and say, I know there's been some problems on this property. I have $5 million cash and we can make those problems go away very rapidly. We're ready to close after a normal due diligence period. And a lot of people took us up on that. Now we're 175, 180 degrees away from that. Now, owners, there's very little product on the market. And that's been a significant change. Now the owners, the sellers, have the keys to the kingdom. Now the lever is in their hand, if you'll pardon the multiple metaphors. As a result, as a result, with lower properties to sell, my company is to have started working almost exclusively with off-market properties. In my own case, what I've done is my marketing assistant and I, we call owners directly. We're not looking for listings so much as we know who the buyers are. If they'll say, yeah, I would consider an offer at a reasonable price, then we take their financials, we develop what they're worth, and I've got a list of ready buyers. We closed a 57-unit property in Battleground last month, and we just went under contract for a 30-unit property in Vancouver a few days ago. We're finding that the off-market approach is really the best way to go.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine that if a seller's interested in selling and is being presented, pretty much what I have a buyer and it's a legitimate buyer as opposed to going through the exercise of listing and having all the tire kicking and all the beat down that kind of goes with it. I mean, I've never, and I've got just some, smaller single family rentals and stuff, but I did go through that one time where a broker said, hey, I got a buyer and didn't work out. And then he asked me to go ahead and list it. And next thing I know, I was like, everybody was there trying to work me on the price. I said, you said you had a buyer, And,
yeah.
And I said, let's knock this off because it was kind of a circus. But
yeah,
truly in this marketplace, especially in multifamily, that's clearly not. I'm sure there's, the usual, the window of discovery there, the due diligence and all that to make sure it measures up kind of thing. But what kind of cap rates are you seeing these properties trade for?
Well, we're looking even on older properties. I've seen sub 4.6% cap rates. Now, most of my investors like to have a spread of a couple hundred, 150 to 200 basis points between the capitalization, the acquisition cap rate, and the finance rate. So if you buy it at a 5 cap and can finance the debt at 3.5%, you get that 150 basis points, 1.5% differential, and that's where they can make some money.
The properties are cash flowing at that point, and they're
yeah. And my guys are all cash flow guys. I don't. And once you get into above a few million bucks, the investors are all looking at cash flow. And for many of the larger investors, they're not looking for the big payday when they sell. They're living off the monthly or quarterly cash flows from the asset. And right. For that reason, they're putting down 30% of the purchase price as equity, some even more, some up to 40 or 50%. system.
Right. And I was going to say, for some of those lower caps, I would think you would have to come in with a bit more equity to.
You do. Now, in some cases, there was a 100 and some units that were sold, that was sold in Tigard at a 4.6 cap. And it was a 30-year-old building. And traditionally, you wouldn't think of that low of cap, capitalization rate being making sense on an asset of that age. But in this particular case, the buyer recognized that there was significant upside on the rents. There and they were in a good location, which meant they could upgrade the asset, upgrade the finishes and so forth, and via renovation, raise the value. So they may have bought at an actual of 4.6%, but they may have actually been at a 6-point-something% by the time all the upgrades were taken into account.
Got it. So the market, what you're saying essentially is the kind of the reverse. You have buyers and you're out hunting for the off market opportunity that isn't a known opportunity yet.
And that's actually a good deal for the seller, because sellers are inundated with guys saying, you know, I have a buyer. Well, in my case, I actually do have a buyer, and I tell them that if my buyer doesn't buy, I'm not asking them for a listing, and that seems to create a difference in the minds of the folks I'm working with. Because I'm not a listing agent. I want to be my strength is in representing a tenant or a buyer, and knowing the market and being an assertive, sometimes aggressive advocate for that person's best interests, lowest price, and best terms.
If somebody's coming to you looking for an opportunity to play in the Portland market, what kind of funds are you, would you think somebody'd have to be able to come with and ability to finance? I mean, is there a price point or you can point to where the opportunities would start to open up, or is there a,
well, it's actually a quantity game. Properties that have 30 to 50 units start being in the range where it's profitable, because you can then afford to have on-site management. Without on-site management, it's tough on a smaller property, you can't afford on-site management. So you also can't afford to run it as efficiently as it should be. And properties that have an on-site manager they clearly are run better and safer for the tenants, because there's somebody there minding the store.
Right. That all makes sense. Hey, one of the other things that you had kind of brought to my mind or brought to my attention, we were talking before this a little bit about how the offer and escrow, some of the things you're seeing that have changed there. Can you elaborate a little bit on that and tell? I mean,
sure. Well, and I won't say this is a change. Some of these things have always been around. It's just maybe we're seeing them more often. So, an example. On a property recently, my client offered to put $400,000 down as in escrow, being fully refundable until contingencies were removed. And the seller said, you know what? I don't want to tie up your money. Just give me $10,000, much less. But I wanted to go hard immediately. By going hard, I mean not being refundable. And the we then negotiated some language into the contract that said, in the case that there's fraud involved, we do get the money back. But I thought that was interesting. The other thing that we're seeing is, for a long time, the escrow, the money that is hard, that is non-refundable, was transferred from the escrow holding company to the party getting the funds at closing. Now, more and more, we're seeing people say, you know, when the money goes hard, it's released. And in some cases where you might have a period to work on financing, that might mean that they would get that deposit or whatever the funds are up to 90 days sooner. So that's something different.
So in that, I mean, typically what I've recognized and understood is when you offer up a contract, you're in agreement, the contract has some terms with respects to deposit, to signify the buyer's interest or, you know, commitment to the effort there. So are all of the conditions still in play then? I mean, as far as if there's repairs,
sure.
Or so if we go through the inspection and we find out there's a roof or any of that, that's still in play. And
yes,
I mean, is the buyer then that much more committed to, I mean, I would assume that, you know, the seller's not, or the buyer's not going to agree to this unless he's got firm commitment that everybody is, this deal's going to happen. It's just a matter,
yes,
of what are the fine details. Is that essentially what that?
Yeah. And, you know, it was an interesting process because $10,000 is actually much more money than the holding of the $400,000 would have been for the period of time involved.
Sure.
So, but it's even though it's a much smaller amount, it all, the fact that it was non-refundable made the buyer say, I need to be really sure that this is attractive to me before I go. And so we did pre-due diligence. We did a significant amount of studying of the neighborhoods. We did rent surveys. We checked Craigslist. We really did most of our due diligence before even signing the purchase and sale agreement, which at which point the $10,000 was submitted to escrow and became hard and so forth.
Right, and in that process, were you able to acquire any of the rent rolls, et cetera, from the seller, or was that?
In some cases, yes. Now, I have one institutional client. I worked for a Native American tribe that had oil money, and their procedure was they wouldn't even make an offer until they had all copies of all the leases. Now, that was not an apartment situation. I was helping them buy office buildings at that point. But yeah, they look at everything before they even make an offer.
Well, it would seem to make sense to know what you're making. I guess you could do it one of two ways. Like I said, if you know the surrounding area and you understand the marketplace, and you can run your numbers based on that, make your offer, you know, based on what you assume to be the the marketplace. Interesting.
Well, and one of the things that they rely on is having a good broker that is willing to do that extra work without the promise of a sale going through. Because you could do a lot of work and find out, no, this isn't the right place. And in that case, the value of a good broker representing you in acquisition is much like having a great broker that represents you with your insurance needs.
I like that. That's good. The in the market frenzy, if you will, I mean, this, you know, right now the market has more buyers than sellers. I mean, yes. The buyers are recognizing there's not enough. They're not finding the properties they want, so they're coming to people like you and saying, "Rick, I got this much money. Find me a deal."
That money sometimes is a couple $100,000, and they look for a triplex to a eight, because they can with $200,000 down, they can buy an asset somewhere between $600,000 and $800,000.
Right.
With $2 million, they're looking at assets anywhere from $4 million to $8 million in equity.
Right.
And this market makes, 1031 exchanges are more difficult in this market, which is why it's important for them to have the proper resources on their side, the buyers, to have the proper resources on their side so they can do the second leg effectively of their 1031 exchange. The first leg's always easier than the second, or almost always.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because I've experienced what was referred to as a reverse exchange, and I don't know all of the particulars.
In a reverse exchange, you buy your replacement property and then sell your original property, and you have up to 180 days to close. So you've got 180 days to make decisions. On the traditional forward exchange, you have 45 days to identify replacement properties. And it's the 45 days, not the 180 days to complete the transaction. It's the 45 days that puts people in a pinch.
Right. Especially in the
my clients like to know where they're going before they close on their first leg.
Yeah, full speed ahead. Where are we going? I don't know.
Right now I'm working on with a client that I've been working for a couple weeks on finding a replacement property in the $8 to $25 million range, and they just closed recently. But I've been working on that well in advance of their actual closing.
Got it. Well, is there, the couple things we talked about that I thought were interesting, I think the listeners would appreciate is the, how much value there is in actually working with a broker to find those off-market properties. Because if you're just hunting around on LoopNet or whatever, you're probably not finding the opportunities.
I personally am a big fan of CoStar. It's my key resource. I've used Pierce Island. I've used LoopNet. CoStar, though, to me is the best. But even using that, you have to develop relationships with the owners of product versus the and without that, you can't do it. Well, as a private person, if you're not paying $6,000 or $7,000 a year for CoStar and don't get the benefits of all that and have the time and grade and relationships that have developed over time, it's just hard to compete with brokers. Now, the bigger properties, the ones that are 40, 50, $100 million properties, those sometimes don't even have brokers on both sides, and sometimes they don't have brokers on either side. And that's because people know where they are. But your 30 or 50 unit apartment complex, not everybody in the city of Portland knows where that is, and that knowledge of knowing where things are, what they're going for, that's where the benefit is derived.
So on those larger properties you were just referring to, is that basically institution?
Strictly institutional. Now, there are some very high net worth individuals that are playing in those markets, but they act as an institutional buyer. Institutional buyer, some of them are actually a little more agile than the institutional buyers because they can decide without going to a committee or anything whether or not an acquisition is the proper one. The high net worth guys, that is. But in terms of the way they approach due diligence and so forth, it's the same as a strictly institutional, you know, TIA, CREF, or whatever.
Right. Hey, wanted to ask you on that hard money on the deposit.
Well, sure.
Is that a strategy that you would encourage a buyer that would really trying to get the attention of the seller, or is that kind of something you've seen pushed from the seller back to the buyer?
Well, it's something that they could offer, and it does show a higher level of interest than a fully refundable earnest money. You know, one of the things that buyers who really want to get ahead of the game might consider is going to finding a good buyer's agent and saying, I will use you exclusively, and saying to that buyer's agent, I will pay you a fee of X. So when you go talk to owners, you tell them that the buyer is paying the brokerage fee, and they will have no brokerage fee unless they decide to get someone to represent themselves.
Huh.
And that would make it more attractive because the seller is saving some money. One of the key things that is in any transaction is the commissionectomy that happens when the buyer and the seller squeeze that doesn't always happen. It's when they reduce the commission sometimes to make a deal go. The saying amongst brokers is, we're only a fee apart.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a way that some aggressive buyers who really want to make a strong push into a market, that's something they consider is working with a single buyer's representative, buyer broker, and only paying them. Because that way they don't have to pay both sides.
Got it.
So they can go in with a smaller amount.
So at that point then, if the property were off market, then would you be looking for a fee from the seller then too, or is it just hey, look, don't worry about me.
There's a lot of great brokers that represent both sides of the deal. I always thought that brokers were paid sufficiently if they do a good job, that they only need to represent one side. And what I like to do is, provide, like I mentioned that earlier, the assertive and sometimes aggressive advocacy for my client. Well, you know, I think I mentioned to you that I love Swiss watches, I love Swiss chocolate, but when it comes to business, I don't want someone working with me that thinks the Swiss neutrality is great. I want someone who's going to aggressively push for what's best for me. And I think most people see the value in that too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole thing. You're seeking out an expert that, has that expertise and is going to work for you, not just trying to, you know, get a one transaction and down the road they go kind of thing. So no, I think that's...
Well, I had one client that said, I'm looking at two properties. One is in Lake Oswego, Oregon's number one community as far as economics and demographics, and the other was in Northeast Portland. And I said, well, I think you ought to buy the one in Northeast Portland, and that basically cut my fee in half because it was a smaller property. But I felt that that property had much more upside, and so I told the client that, well, most people would prefer to have someone who's willing to do that for them than someone who's neutral. Because if I'd been neutral, I would have clearly told them the higher property. Anyway,
I think that really is that's the character of the broker matters. You know, if you
I think so, and there's a lot of good brokers out there.
Right, but also that kind of speaks to your experience too. I think just in what I've seen out there is that, you know, an experienced broker has the understanding of that. You know, this is it's a much bigger stage than this one deal.
And if I get you in
a bad deal today, you're not going to say anything nice about me. You may not do well, and I'd rather see you do well. And come back and let's do this again and tell all your other investor friends about me. So
it's a lot easier to get to keep a great client than to find one. And the differential is, the ethics and the degree to which people pursue the best interests of their client.
I hear you. Rick, is there anything that we were wanting to talk about
there is. You mentioned something about capitalization rates that I didn't really fully answer. One of the things that's going on now is the range between the lowest and the highest cap rates is compressed. That is to say, there's been, in the old days, you used to see, well, you might have a real attractive asset trading at a 6 cap, and the less desirable, maybe it was in a tertiary market, maybe it wasn't kept up in tip-top shape, that might be at an 11 cap. I'm talking years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a spread of 5 points. Well, now, you see the very worst assets trading at fairly reasonable rates simply because this is partially a function of the affordability of the debt, but also just the investor's view of the value of commercial real estate is so improved that cap rates have come down. I think they've come down as far as they're going to go.
What's kind of the spread you're seeing now for the...
I still think that... I think you're below 5 on attractive core assets. Some are even closer to 4. That's not the norm, I wouldn't say. And in most of those cases, the reason they're being able to pay such a low capitalization rate is because they have an end use that is going to create an effective capitalization rate that's much higher by improving the property. On a 100-unit property, if you raise the rents $50 a month, you've created $5,000 a month, $60,000 a year, and raised the value of the property some number like $1.2 million at time of sale. So just small increments
make a big deal
in this market.
What's kind of the high end on the cap you're seeing in the marketplace?
Well, there are always individual flyers. I don't see much in multifamily. I don't see anything above 7%. And if we're talking about larger properties that are, you know, well located, be, you know, more like 6. Or as low as 5. I mean, I just sold the property at a, you know, roughly a 5.25 cap in Battleground, Washington. So Battleground, Washington is not necessarily a hot spot for low cap rates, and yet, you know, it was a good buy for that client.
Hey, let me ask you something, because the cap rate, I mean, I understand it's function of net operating income divided by the value or divided by the cap to determine the value of the property. But if I buy a property today at a 5 cap, go on for 10 years and everything stays the same, is it likely to assume that it will trade again at a 5 cap on the sale, or is that still just a function of supply and demand on the?
It can change. Cap rates do change, and historically, you know, with the exception of the last 10-15 years, historically cap rates have been significantly higher, which means that the each dollar of net operating income is less valuable. At a 10 cap, every dollar of net operating income is worth $10 at time of sale. If you get down to a 5 cap, every dollar of NOI is now worth $20 at time of sale.
Right.
So it's the same income. It's just that one is more valued than the other. And that's also a thing you see between asset classes. $100,000 net operating income in an apartment might make that asset worth something like $100,000 might be worth $2 million, but $100,000 in a motel that might only be worth $1 million, even though it's the same amount of money. It's where you have to consider. That's the thing about real estate. It's real estate is always unique, and that there's only one place and one set of conditions.
Right. No, that's always a good to know and good to understand, and like you were explaining before, that the spread on the cap to the financing, and if you're able to come in with more cash make that. I mean, that was something I hadn't really paid much attention to, that spread there between the cap rate and the finance rate before. It was always kind of more of a function of, the cap rate was your return, or at least the kind of an expression of a value in relation to what the operating income was. But then, you know, if you're borrowing, you got to, the bank's going to look at the cover ratio. So it's.
Yes.
You know, you can get all the way.
During the recession, I had a deal that was getting ready to close, and the banker called me up and said, "Oh boy, do I have some bad news." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, your client's going to need to come up with 50% more equity." And I said, "Well, he's 83 years old. He's got a 1031 exchange. This is the money he has. There is." Oh, he said, "Oh, too bad. Oh, we can't do the deal." And this was going to make my client not be able to finish the deal, which meant that he would be liable for all the taxes because of this bank's decision. And the guy said, "Well, we'll get together some deal. I don't want you to forget about me." And I said, "Oh, I promise you I won't forget about what you've done." So anyway.
Well, I'm sure they didn't offer that up in the first review. That was probably something.
They were happy as clams, and then all of a sudden, it was during a time when the market was changing, and the bank changed their mind. But their, an institutional situation, they probably wouldn't have been able to do that because there would have been guarantees that the loan would move forward before we had gotten to that point. But we didn't have that option with this gentleman.
Got it. Yeah. Well, Rick, this has been enlightening. And thank you for taking some time today to share with me what's going on and what you're, you know, what you're seeing out there in the marketplace. Before I let you go, two things. One, I hope you would be willing to come back and do it again. And the other, I wanted to see if you have a contact information you want to put out there for any of our listeners that might be interested in talking.
Absolutely. I'm Rick Dean, D-E-A-N, with Rose City Commercial Real Estate. And I'm at 503-577-1034. It's my phone number. And then Rick at RoseCityCRE.com is my email address.
All right.
And to answer your other question, I'd be delighted to do this again.
Good. Well, I've enjoyed it, and I think it's always useful to have some sort of a perspective on what's going on and anything we can glean from, you know, what is actually happening on the ground. I'm sure that with the listeners is always greatly appreciated.
Well, I thank you for your time.
Well, the commercial real estate market is hot. There's lots of buyers and not so many sellers. And in order to be successful in a marketplace like that, you need an experienced broker to help you. As we heard from Rick, a lot of properties are off market. And so how are you going to find those? It sounds like working with a buyer's broker is a good way to go. I've listed on the show notes Rick's contact information and encourage you to reach out to him if you're looking to invest in the Portland market. I know he'd take good care of you. Before we get out of here, I want to remind you, if you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe. We'd love to, we'd love to have you come aboard. You'll know exactly when any new episodes are posted, and you'll have the chance to listen to them whenever it works for you. We know you're busy, so thanks for making time for us today. We really appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Networks, CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.